Retro.
Go.
Vital.
We're go fly.
Guidance.
Guidance, go.
Procedures.
Go.
Capcom.
We're go fly.
Launch control, this is Houston. We are go for launch.
This is Space Talk, a weekly program that highlights America's space program and what's new in space flight from around the globe. And now, with the past, present, and future of space exploration, here is Jim Behnke.
Greetings from Florida's Space Coast, home of the most skilled aerospace workforce in America. I'm Jim Behnke, and this is the August 12th, 2012 edition of Space Talk, live on the air right here on WMMB. Well, good afternoon, everyone. Thanks for joining us on this Sunday afternoon for another hour of discussion about our space program on this, the first weekend following the inspiring, triumphant, and I think near miraculous landing of the Curiosity rover on Mars. It was a welcome addition to the list of historical space achievements. But where on that list does the event fall? Well, we'll get a clue today as we talk with my special guest, Roger Lamias, a longtime space historian who is now with the National Air and Space Museum. He'll join us shortly. Hey, if you listened to the program last week and are tuning in today because you heard we were going to talk about model rocketry and the space program, I apologize, but you'll have to wait at least one more week thanks to a hiccup in the schedule for one of the guests who will join us. But I guarantee you want to stick around today because Roger Lamias is always informative and entertaining. And on the off chance that he's not, or if you'd like to change the subject, you can always welcome to join in and participate in the program today with your questions or comments about our space program. Give us a call at 768-1240, the area code 321 if you need it. Or if you'd prefer, give us an email. Send us an email to spacetalking@aol.com. Well, now it's time for my more or less weekly broadcast blog, Orbital Inclinations. And I have some things to say about a variety of topics, so let's call this week's Orbital Inclinations the good, the bad, and the ugly in space. Well, the good, of course, was the successful landing of the Mars rover Curiosity. Like every good self-respecting space cadet, I stayed up most of the night to watch the entry and landing. With NASA TV on one screen and the JPL real-time animation of what was supposed to have happened 14 minutes ago, with the Mars Science Laboratory on another screen, I followed every second of those 7 minutes of terror and found myself struck with awe as each call-out from Mission Control indicated everything was happening just as it should. When the touchdown was confirmed and the control room broke out in a scene, well, reminiscent of a Super Bowl winner's locker room, I just sat there dumbfounded, my brain and heart overloaded with so many thoughts and feelings I couldn't process them all, sort of my own version of a lunar module 1202 program alarm. A week later, with only a handful of stunning photos of the area at Gale Crater seen so far, the science is just beginning to trickle in. Much more, of course, will follow. But from an engineering standpoint, we can declare the $2 billion mission a tremendous success and another giant leap forward for mankind. You know, it's been great to see Facebook and other social media lit up this week with comments and links and references to every new development and image coming from Curiosity, including quite the collection of illustrated memes. My favorite so far is the one that shows a picture of Earth and Mars next to each other. Above Earth, it says, NBC, 6-hour delay for an event 3,500 miles away. And above Mars, it says, NASA, 14-minute delay for an event 155 million miles away. Well, I guess the obligatory Olympic references were inevitable, so why fight it? Strike up the Star-Spangled Banner because Curiosity went for the gold medal, stuck the landing, and made an entire nation proud of the can-do spirit of exploration displayed by the Mars team, and the best is yet to come. As for the bad, well, this past week at the Kennedy Space Center, an unmanned prototype rocket and lunar lander called Morpheus crashed seconds after liftoff from a simulated lunar surface that was set up near the north end of the shuttle landing facility. No one was hurt, but the experimental lander was completely destroyed in the crash and the fire and subsequent explosions of its propellant tanks. Spacecraft had successfully flown a a number of test flights at the Johnson Space Center while attached to a tether hung beneath a large crane. A similar tethered flight was done at KSC as well, but the crash this week came during Morpheus's first untethered test flight. The accident is a setback, of course, but this new vehicle was an experiment in design, manufacturing, and operation. The Morpheus team was trying something new and, well, was seen during the missile heydays here at the Cape so long ago. Sometimes rockets do fail and make spectacular fireworks in the sky. But what this team was working on was important, and despite the accident, remains important and worth pursuing. So I wish them well as they pick up the pieces and learn from whatever mistakes were made, rebuild, and get back flying again. The moon still beckons, and Morpheus could be the way to get there. Well, speaking of returning to the moon, now here comes the ugly. Recently, the Space Coast Economic Development Commission invited representatives of the Obama and Romney campaigns to come here and talk about their plans for NASA and commercial space and related topics as it affects the Kennedy Space Center and the entire Space Coast. An Obama representative did show up and described the president's support for commercial space to low Earth orbit and NASA's plans to return astronauts to deep space exploration with the Orion capsule and Space Launch System heavy lift rocket. Now we can quibble over the details, but at least the Obama team did show up and a thoughtful plan was presented. Now it's unfortunate I can't say the same thing for the Romney camp. Their response was to not show up and submit a written statement that, well, was mind-numbingly embarrassing for its lack of specific detail and for its suggestion that we need yet another presidential panel to study what we should be doing in space. Here's what the Romney campaign said. Governor Romney will provide the clear, decisive, and steadfast leadership the space program requires. As president, Romney will bring together leading officials, researchers, and entrepreneurs to establish clear goals and missions for NASA that fulfill its objectives of spurring innovation, pursuing exploration, and symbolizing American exceptionalism. Not bad, but here's my unsolicited response for the Romney campaign to consider. I'm a lifelong registered Republican who desperately wants to fully support my candidate for president, slap a Romney Ryan bumper sticker on my car, and proudly wear the red, white, and blue elephant pin I bought in our nation's capital shortly after George W. Bush moved into the White House. And as a lifelong space cadet, my bookshelves are filled with presidential blue ribbon studies. In fact, another study on NASA's strategic direction is underway right now by the National Research Council. We don't need another study that will tell us the same thing as all the others did, which is essentially this. We need to reduce the cost of getting into orbit. We need to go back to the moon to learn how to live there and take advantage of its resources. We need to send humans to Mars and other places in the solar system, all the while taking full advantage of the opportunities at every step to enhance our scientific understanding of our world and universe around us, relying on a human and robotic exploration program that has full, aggressive, and stable funding, all done with specific goals for the timing of each milestone understood and with the aim of improving our life here, stimulating our economy, and ensuring our national security. Now, I want to enthusiastically endorse Governor Romney, support him, and ultimately vote for him this November. So far, when it comes to the single issue of our space program, the Romney campaign is making that very difficult. They say politics are ugly, and that's exactly what the Romney plan for space looks like right now. He can change his tune about space, of course. Lord knows our current president did the same thing during his campaign. In any case, that's the good, the bad, and the ugly for this week's Orbital Inclinations. Well, let's take our first break here. When we come back, we'll be joined by space historian Roger Launius. And don't forget to give us a call if you'd like, 321-768-1240, or send us an email to spacetalking@AOL.com. Do please stay tuned. I'm Jim Banky. You're listening to Space Talk right here on WMMB.
Space Talk is back in a minute. Call Jim now at 768-1240. it's happening in space, Jim Behnke is there. Okay, well, not in space, but he's all about it. This is Space Talk on WMMB.
And welcome back, everybody, to Space Talk. 321-768-1240, the number to call today to participate in the program, or send us an email to spacetalking@aol.com. Well, here at the Kennedy Space Center and Cape Canaveral Air Force Station, we make history with every launch. But what happens next in terms of documenting that history and making sure those future generations understand what happened and why it happened and how they can apply those lessons learned? Well, some of that responsibility falls to my guest today. Roger Launius is a former NASA chief historian and is now senior curator for the Division of Space History at the National Air and Space Museum in our nation's capital, where, like all of our presidents, I'd like to believe he took his own oath to preserve, protect, and defend the history of our United States space program. Because if you've ever read anything official in terms of NASA's history, there's a good chance that Roger's had a hand in it in one way or the other. And we welcome Dr. Roger Launius from his home near our nation's capital today. Roger, how are you today, sir?
Just great. Good to be with you.
Good to be with you, and good to talk to you. You know, our paths have crossed so many times, but I don't think we've ever really sat down at the same table and had any kind of a discussion.
Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah, it's fun to have you here. Well, let's start with your background. Tell us where you're from and your time at, 12 years at NASA. How'd you get to where you were to where you are?
Well, and some of it's happenstance. I think that's true of most people's histories. But, I grew up in South Carolina. I was a kid in the 1960s, and I was jazzed by the Apollo program when I was a kid.
Yeah.
Just like everybody was at the time. But when I went on to graduate school, I pursued my interest in 19th century history of the American West, especially a religion in the West. And through a series of interesting turns in my professional career, I went to work for the Air Force after I did my PhD in history. That got me interested in kind of aerospace subjects. And then in 1990, I moved to NASA as the chief historian. And that really has had a big role in redefining my trajectory. And so since 1990, I've pretty much been focused on the history of space flight, first at NASA for 12 years and now for the last decade at the National Air and Space Museum. And I hope everybody has had a chance to visit that museum. And if you do get there at any point, look me up. I'm usually there.
Yeah, really. You know, Roger, it's interesting. You know, I was, like you, a space cadet since I was a kid following Apollo and that. My career path went in different directions and kind of always stuck to space, but with this general idea of wanting to share that excitement with others. As a historian, you know, I've met folks in the past that are pure research historians. They're interested in history, and the topic is kind of secondary. For you, it seems like it's kind of a mix of both, and maybe you're in your ideal world right now.
Oh, I'm in a great place. There's no doubt about that. I like the pure piece of capturing the history, but I'm very focused on how can we use that history to help us understand first where we are and what the trajectory into the future might be. So I do a lot of policy analysis and things of that nature as well.
Well, and that's really interesting to me because, again, you think of history, and I grew up thinking history as, you know, memorizing dates and locations and peoples and all of that. As I've read your work and as I've become, I guess, more mature in my examination of the space program, the history is so much more than just the dates and the times and the places. And you've really kind of, as other historians do, take it to a why did it happen and motivations and those kind of things that are behind the events.
Oh, you bet.
How much of that is so important to what you do?
Oh, it's critical. I mean, it's unfortunate, I think, that a lot of people get exposed to history and they see it as kind of dates that have to be memorized and names and events that need to be memorized, and then they don't much enjoy it for that particular reason. But the reality is, the fun of it is, and what makes it exciting and important for us is these connections of how things have evolved and how we've gotten to the point where we are. And so if you don't understand the long trajectory of 50-plus years of the space age, it's pretty hard to understand The fact that at this point in time we have just retired a space shuttle and are moving into a new stage of human spaceflight activities that may be quite different from what has gone before, but nonetheless is a part of a long process that if you have that understanding, doesn't surprise you all that much.
Yeah, you know, we I don't think anyone here really clearly understands what this all means. We might not understand for another 10, 20 years, but I look back at Apollo and, you know, I was a kid growing up, and as I, in my early adulthood, I still thought of the Apollo program as spirit of exploration. It was all about science. What a great President Kennedy was, all the leadership, and if it weren't for him, we wouldn't be doing any of this. And then as I began to learn that, you know, this was a Cold War response and there were politics involved and it really wasn't all about the pure, you know, I grew up watching Apollo on one channel and Star Trek on the other. And this wasn't about Star Trek anymore. This was about, you know, saying, making a statement to the world in the Cold War against the Soviet Union. That perspective, sometimes we miss that even in our day-to-day lives, you know, to talk about. Well, stand by, Roger. Just want to make sure we still have you. We can just have a big thunderstorm moving over the studio right now.
Oh, yeah.
And I think we're actually on generator power at the moment. So we're still talking to you. You're still on the phone.
But I'm good.
I just want to make sure everybody out there understands what's happening if they hear something weird. In any case, so talking about what we learn about how important some of this other stuff is, I had no idea this was all part of it. So the politics, the space policy and all that, I mean – You've really delved into that, and I think at times you've had some pretty strong opinions. And I guess I'm curious, where does the line between the objective historian and the guy with an opinion? I mean, we have that problem in journalism all the time. What about the historian?
Well, the historians always have opinions. There's no doubt about that. And there's no way to get around that. We used to talk about the search for the truth, and we've come to realize over time that – you know, truth is, there may be an absolute out there, but mostly what we have is a perspective on something that gives us an understanding about it, but other people may have a different perspective, and it's not to say that one is necessarily better than the other. That may be the case, depending upon what is being said, but the reality is it's hard to separate an opinion about these issues from kind of hard-edged facts. And what everybody does who does history in a legitimate kind of questioning way is to take the basic facts, the what, where, how, and when, that you can determine through a variety of research sources, and try to understand the why. And the why part is where a lot of people differ in terms of their analyses. And so people can take those different ideas and come up with different interpretations of it. And maybe they'll be very shaded and very nuanced and not necessarily strikingly different from each other. But all of this is a part of the process of trying to understand the past. And that's what makes it so exciting in my mind.
And this you know, we in today's society we want to rank everything. What was the first? What's the top 10? What's the top 5 or whatever?
Right.
And so you got to kind of make judgments, I would assume, as historians, based on your opinion. Now, for example, and I wanted to get your honest opinion on this. You know, as great as Apollo 11 was, the more I read about it, and I'm influenced by what Mike Collins wrote in his Carrying the Fire book when he said that he thought that Apollo 8. The trip of the first time we left Earth orbit to send humans around the moon was actually more important in the grand scheme of things than even the landing itself.
Yeah.
And I was curious about what you think about that, and then how do those opinions apply into this idea of, well, what's important and what's not?
Yeah, it really depends on how you want to define that idea of important or most significant or something like that. Apollo 8 was critically significant because it was indeed the first time we sent humans beyond Earth orbit, and we went to the moon. It was also critically important because of the striking image, Earthrise, that emerged from that,
right,
and the Christmas Eve broadcast, which really reshaped our understanding of our planet and ourselves on this planet and in the cosmos. So it was enormously important. Now, was it more important than the actual first landing? That's hard to say.
Yeah.
I mean, I could make a case on both sides, and you probably could too.
Right.
And, you know, setting foot on that new world was critically important as well. But then you have to ask yourself the question, what about a mission like Apollo, say, 15, the first one that had the lunar rover? That
right.
was a very exceptional scientific mission.
Or when the Genesis rock was discovered. Or even the perspective of time that you allow that, you know, back then, Apollo 13, you kind of brushed it under the mat as we didn't want to talk about it. And now it's the most celebrated. There's more Apollo 13 stuff on sale in the souvenir shop here than there is Apollo 11.
Absolutely. Or Apollo 17 the last time we were there.
Yeah.
So it's really hard to make a value judgment. It is a value judgment. Yeah. I can argue a case for every one of those missions.
Yeah, yeah. And I think ultimately we just need to understand that Apollo was important because, again, 100 years from now, maybe people won't even remember there were these individual missions, but they'll just remember that back in the 20th century, halfway through, we wound up going to the moon and we explored the moon, at least
a portion of the moon.
Roger, stand by, buddy. We're going to take our usual five-minute built-in hold here at the bottom of the hour and get everybody caught up on the latest news, weather, and sports. Hopefully the power will stay with us, and we'll be back with you here in about 5 minutes. In the meantime, feel free to give us a call, 768-1240. Send us an email to spacetalking@aol.com if you have a question or comment. We're happy to talk to you. I'm Jim Banky. You're listening to Space Talk right here on WMMB.
If you missed part of the show, catch the podcast, Space Talk, in the on-demand section at WMMBAM.com. Listen to Space Talk on the web at WMMBAM.com.
And welcome back to our second half of Space Talk here on WMMB. Hey, we still have power in the studio. We're doing fine. Hope you are, too. Our phone lines and online inbox are open for your questions or comments. The phone number 321-768-1240. The email address is spacetalking@aol.com. Well, we got clouds overhead right now. I had clouds over my house most of the night. Maybe you did, too. Completely missed the Perseids meteor shower. Which peaked this morning just before sunrise. I don't know if we'll still have any kind of decent chance tonight and tomorrow morning, but it may be worth heading out there and looking up to the northeast for a little bit. Hey, today on the program we have Dr. Roger Lanius, a senior space historian with the National Air and Space Museum, talking to us about all things space history. Roger, thanks for sticking around with us, and thanks for being on the phone with us today.
Yeah, you bet. Glad to do it.
Great. Hey, before we get into it, I want to spend a little time talking about the mechanics of what you do. But before we do that, I was just curious about something. When I am out at the Cape, and like I'm at Pad 34, or I'm in the high bay of the ONC where the Apollo spacecraft were checked out, or even walking down the sterile hallways of the headquarters building, I have this sense of history. It almost reminds me of feeling the Force from Star Wars. It's just that you feel that sense of history. It's not a smell. I can't describe it, but I sense it. It's a presence. How about you? Are you historically sensitive like that too? Do you go to a historic place and just almost get goosebumps?
Oh yeah, there's no question about that. And many places and many times. Not just space sites, obviously, but you kind of are caught up in the experience of what took place there. And it may be things that you knew well before you arrived. I mean, you know the story of what took place at Pad 34, for instance,
sure.
and obviously in the VAB. And so there's this kind of reverence almost that kind of washes through you, especially if you're in a setting that is kind of awe-inspiring. And certainly the VAB is. It's so big and breathtaking.
Yeah. Yeah.
You can really reflect on the enormously significant historic events that took place there and almost be overwhelmed. It's almost like an epiphany.
Yeah. Have you ever had a chance to really crawl around the VAB and really get into the guts rather than sort of the standard tour?
Well, I've gotten back into some of the places where the public doesn't go on a regular basis.
Yeah.
It's not that I've crawled around in there and kind of been able to do whatever I wanted, but certainly I've been to some of the closed off places.
I'll tell you a quick story. There was one time right after the online thing started, and we had started Space Online at Florida Today. I wanted to do a photo history tour of the VAB. This was before we had QuickTime Virtual and stitching and all that kind of stuff. Anyway, Mike Brown, the photographer at Florida Today, and I went with one of the PAOs at NASA, and we literally were crawling around the VAB. And we came around to this first of all, we came around an elevator, and there was this whole floor of men's urinals just sitting out in the open, which was kind of interesting. But we went to a door, and it was just this door, and you opened this door. It was a closet, and there was a broom and a dustpan sitting there. Now, we have no idea who it belonged to, how long it had sat there, or if we were the first ones to see it in 30 years. But right. You just got that sense of, like, what's this story? You know, what's this history? What's the story behind this? And what I'm getting at, Roger, is it's the people and their stories that, to me, is so interesting about the history. Not just the technical details, not just the facts and figures, but the motivations that we talked about, but the stories. The stories of, you know, even now a shuttle with the bean tradition and eating beans after every launch and all that. What are some of those stories? You know, to ask a historian for his favorite story, and know we only have 6 minutes to talk before the next break.
Yeah. But, I mean, there's so many. It's almost impossible. I was struck by talking to some of the folks down there, and one of the very senior engineers down there, a woman engineer who actually went to work there before it was NASA, while it was still at as a part of the Air Force program.
Sure.
She said she went into the blockhouse the first day after she'd been hired, and there she did not realize this was the case, but there was no ladies' room.
Well, you're talking about Joanne Morgan, of course.
I am.
Yes, absolutely.
You know the story.
I know her very well. We're good friends.
Okay. And, I mean, it's just so striking that that was the case.
Yeah.
And that she had to get a guard to basically go with her into the men's room and make sure that there was no one in there, and then stand guard outside while she took care of business and then come back to work. And that's a truly fascinating, little-known story that says a lot about the nature of the engineering culture and how it's changed over time now, for the better, I think. But that was the nature of things at the time. A small story, but nonetheless one that I think is very illuminating.
You know, as a researcher, you know, and you look for source material, there's obviously a great deal of official source material, but there's unofficial stuff out there. There's certainly all the newspaper clippings. As a journalist, we were always reminded and always felt like we were, writing the first version of history.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm right now in the middle of reading Martin Caden, the late Marty Caden's book, The Cape.
Okay.
And there is I don't know if you've ever read it, but there's a tremendous amount of history that's real history in there, shrouded by a little bit of fiction.
Okay,
And you wonder, you know, when you read these, but like Michener's Space book, which is just a great classic, there's a tremendous amount of real history in there, kind of hidden between. You kind of have to pick and you kind of have to know what's real and what's not. But to what extent does that popular fiction and popular sources of material helpful to you as historians?
It's very helpful. I mean, we couldn't do it without those kinds of things. And there's been very good accounts written by journalists that are nonfiction in the truest sense of the term, but might have some dialogue that's been inserted that may or may not be absolutely accurate.
Yeah.
But at some level, some of that is a little bit like poetry. Poetry is not intended to be an actual true statement of fact necessarily, but it should get to this issue of what is really important, and it often does. So if you read a book, say, The Right Stuff, which is probably the most famous of those types of books, you can – and he took a lot of liberties with the material, Tom Wolfe did, but he told a story that was really intriguing and got to the heart of some things that were really quite important, even if not every aspect of it was the truth.
And then even if the filmmakers butchered some of it anyway.
Oh, and the film, of course, takes a work like Wolfe's book, which is it's got its own issues, and just compounds it in ways that are unbelievable.
And yet still remains one of my top five favorite movies of all time. You know,
it captures a lot of really interesting things. But, you know, I was asked at one point, you know, what's the truest thing that you saw in that particular movie? And I searched through my recollections of the film, and the only thing I could really come up with was, let me tell you, the thing that was the most striking about that film was how they captured that last launch right at the end of the movie, the Gordon Cooper launch.
Yeah.
With the audience there and with the emotions associated with that particular flight. I thought they did a good job there.
Yeah, and I always like Trudy Cooper in her white gloves, too, you know.
Yes, but, right.
Well, yeah, and funny, it's funny, the other thing I like about that movie, that's it's not accurate, obviously, but have you ever noticed that every time there are the news media kind of a crawling and attacking and doing their thing, and I'm mm-hmm. guilty of it in my history, too, that the sound of locusts are played in the background?
Yeah, I noticed that.
It's classic. Well, Roger, as you're talking about the mechanics of doing the history, you know, I'm interested in the popular history.
Right.
We here at NASA, you have the whole public affairs operation taking a bunch of great pictures. But some of the great pictures and documentation, of course, is on the technical side.
Right.
When you were chief historian for NASA, and even as you do your work here at the NASM, where's the balance? Where's the line? What's the attention on that? Are you worried about the technical history or the popular history, or how do you draw that distinction?
Well, I'm worried about every aspect of it, and there's a variety of parts to any part of these programs and their history. I mean, there's obviously the technical details, which are captured in the technical reports and
sure.
the studies done by the engineers and the various program reviews and on and on and on, that we have to be very careful to try to capture, and we also try to capture that with oral histories of individuals who are associated with it to try to find out what happened in that particular room on that particular day when some major decision was made.
Sure.
And then there's other pieces to that. There's obviously things like a political history that's very important when we're talking about something like the space program.
Right.
Because it's a very top-down government type of activity, less so maybe today than it was during Apollo, but nonetheless, still very much so.
Sure.
There is a social history which requires us to capture aspects of it that are strikingly different. I mean, what takes place during the public coming to view a launch, for instance?
Mm-hmm. Well, the L-2 parties before every shuttle launch. You know, would that be chronicled by you somewhere?
Well, yeah. I mean, in theory, and it could be. I haven't done that particular type of work, but other people have.
Sure.
And there's that sort of activity. There's this larger cultural milieu. The changes, say, in the Space Coast during the 1960s, as this large number of scientists and engineers come into the area, which really transform it in pretty fundamental ways. And how does that happen? So there's that kind of activity as well, and lots of things beyond that.
Yeah. Hey, we're just about ready to take our last break. Roger, just a quick question. If I wanted to know which way a valve was thrown 3 years ago in a shuttle processing flow, I wouldn't come to you necessarily to find that photo or that document.
Not necessarily. That should be captured through the technical management
yeah.
program, especially the quality assurance program that's a part of NASA.
Okay. Well, hey, Roger, stand by. We're going to take our final break of the day. When we come back, we'll wrap up our discussions for the week, and we'll take a look at the local launch forecast and get you caught up on what's going on there as well. I'm Jim Bank. You're listening to Space Talk right here on WMMB.
Space Talk is back in a minute. Call Jim now at 768-1240. Call Jim now, 768-1240.
And welcome back as we begin our final segment of today's edition of Space Talk with your reminder that you can stay in touch with us throughout the week. If you're on Facebook, you can like us at Space Talk. If you're on Twitter, follow Space Talking. And for one-stop shopping, just visit WMMBAM.com, keywords Space Talk. Now let's take a moment for our weekly look at the local launch forecast. We're now 11 days away from the planned launch of an Atlas V rocket from Cape Canaveral Air Force Station. United Launch Alliance boosters to carry a pair of NASA science satellites on the Radiation Belt Storm Probes mission. Liftoff is targeted for 4:08 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time. The Atlas V is now fully stacked at Launch Complex 41 at Cape Canaveral Air Force Station. The final piece was the nose cone that contains the twin probes, which were put in place atop the rocket this past Friday. Once in orbit, the spacecraft will fly within the Van Allen radiation belts surrounding our planet and study the effects of space weather on those bands of charged particles. For more information about this and all the various launches scheduled around the world, jump on the web to WMMBAM.com, keyword Space Talk, and look for the link there to our launch forecast. By the way, on the subject of the calendar, don't forget the tickets still are on sale for the Kennedy Space Center's 50th anniversary gala to be held September 22nd at the Apollo Saturn V Center at KSC. The black tie optional event will feature dinner and dancing. It's being hosted by KSC and the National Space Club Florida Committee. Tickets are $80 each. Seating is limited, and we are now less than 100 tickets away from a sellout. So get them now while they're hot. For a link to more information or to purchase tickets, again, go to Space Talk page at WMMBAM.com, and you'll see a link there to follow. On the phone with us from his home near the nation's capital, Dr. Roger Lanius from the National Air and Space Museum has been talking to us, chief space historian up there. Roger, as we've been talking about some of the mechanics of how you do your business, and we've only just got a few minutes left.
Sure.
One of our mutual friends who works in the Air Force world, there was a couple of years where we kind of joked about it that he kind of just disappeared. And we later learned that he was writing some history for, and I don't remember whether it was the Blackbird or the SR-7, not the SR-71, whether it was the F-117 stealth fighter or the
mm-hmm,
B-2,
right.
I can't remember what it was. But when it was still classified, he was out doing the work of the historian while the program was still underway. And so my question really is, how much of what you do as a historian is worried about stuff now as opposed to digging through stuff back then?
Yeah, a lot of it is very present tense. And there's obviously, a lot of work that gets done in the classified realm, because so much of space activities, not so much at NASA, but certainly in the Department of Defense, is very highly classified. And the historians who work on that, and there are always some historians who are engaged there, are putting together materials. They are collecting documents. They are conducting oral histories. They are writing studies that essentially go into vaults and will stay there until they can be declassified.
But what about in the case, Roger, of like the space shuttle program? When the next mission came up as a reporter, you made sure you got the press kit, the notepad,
right,
the fact sheets, and put them in a box somewhere.
Right.
Do you do that same kind of work?
We do the same kind of thing there. We may go a little bit farther. Well, journalists do too, though. We go talk to people who are engaged in the program to get their recollections on tape, and those tapes may simply go into a box for a while and
sure,
not anything be done with them for immediately.
But they're captured.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's exactly right.
And so now with the shuttle program shutting down, you know, it's been kind of fun to watch. And again, I've left journalism now for about 8 years, but all my former colleagues are getting to walk, do, sit, be everywhere they never were allowed before.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You've got tremendous access to things you just didn't have access before. Again, how does that help the historian? And in all of that, Roger, how do you take advantage today of the digital age, of the fact that so much of this is now on CDs and DVDs and computer tapes and whatnot?
Yeah, well, that's one of the things that historians are wrestling with, and we have enormous challenges before us on that sort of thing, because we really need to, since everything is created in a digital format, virtually everything today, in some form or another, we can't just rely upon that being available to us down the road, because the tapes will be erased or the computer systems will be evolved farther so they won't be able to read whatever
right,
the file is set up in today. So we have to really spend a lot of time trying to capture that data in real time and preserving it in a way that we'll be able to access it into the future. Emails are an enormous problem, for instance. I've forgotten the percentages necessarily, but probably half of the business conducted between people in terms of communication is done over email traffic.
Right.
How do you capture that critical piece of it and separate the things that are important from, you know, the casual notes, hey, I'm
the
going
minutia
to lunch at such
yeah,
and such
right,
a place, you want to come.
Right. Yeah, I mean, some of the famous memos from Dr. Wunder von Braun, you know,
right,
are still out there. But if he were doing email today, you know, who knows what you'd be able to capture. So
yeah, it's an enormous challenge for us. And the National Archives, which is really charged with the preservation of federal records, is really twisting itself into knots, trying to figure out the best ways to try to accomplish this task.
Yeah, and I'm sure it's no different than when we hear the science folks. You get all this tremendous gigabytes, terabytes of data down, and you know it's going to take years for you to sift through and figure it out. Hey, real quick, Roger, with about a minute left, you know, on this issue of shuttle program ending and kind of history moving on to the next thing, one of the issues that came up here locally, as you may know, is NASA, KSC, was announcing that they were going to tear down Hangar S. Mm-hmm. At the Cape, which was the great hangar where the Mercury astronauts lived, worked, you know, here during the early days, and it's a very important hangar historically. However, it's just a building. We have no money to maintain it. In about 30 seconds, what do we do with, not necessarily Hangar S specifically, but with all this stuff that's still left? Do we need to save everything?
Well, we can't save everything. I mean, that's the preservationist in me, the historian in me says, let's save it all. But we can't do that. So what's the next best thing? And there are key things that should be preserved, that we need to make sure are preserved, and then there are a lot of things that we need to document. We need to get photography, video, the collection of various types of written records, on and on and on,
sure,
to show that history, even though we might have to tear down that building.
Well, Roger, it's a great job what you're doing. I envy what you're doing. I want to be a part of it someday when I grow up. And and thanks.
We should talk.
Yeah, we should talk. And thanks so much for being on the program today. I really do appreciate it. And we'll stay in touch, okay?
You bet. Hey, thank you.
Thanks, Roger. Take care now. Okay, well, there goes Roger Lanius from the National Air and Space Museum, and thanks to him again. Hey, next week on Space Talk, we'll be more successful in spending our time talking about the hobby of model rocketry, so important to inspiring our future space engineers and scientists, and maybe even an astronaut or two. We'll be joined by my friends from Embry-Riddle, Wes Olszewski from Dr. Zuch Rockets, and Patrick McCarthy, who by day is with Space Florida, but in his spare time as a nationally renowned and award-winning model rocketeer. That will be the topic for next week. Don't forget to stay in touch with us at WMMBAM.com, keyword Space Talk. That's all for now. Space Talk is a production of Mylas Solutions and is brought to you thanks to the generous help of our supporting sponsors, Space Florida, Boeing, Abacus Technology, SpaceX, United Launch Alliance, and Lockheed Martin. Thanks, as always, to Sean Williams for manning the ops station for today. Please join us next Sunday at 3 p.m. for another edition of Space Talk. Stay tuned now for the best of Bill Mick Live. And, hey, don't forget to vote this week on Tuesday in the Florida primary. I'm Jim Behnke. We'll talk to you again real soon.